It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says the conditions that led to Donald Trump's presidential win in 2016 are repeating themselves in many ways here in 2020. We'll talk with him about what he says it would take for Democrats to win back the White House this fall. First, for the next half hour, we're going to talk about challenges facing Native American youth and work that's being done to help them. And a note to listeners before we start, the discussion could include mentions and descriptions of some heavy topics, including child abuse, sexual assault, and youth suicide. Now, a single photograph in the newspaper changed the course of one, if not many, lives. Byron Dorgan was reading that newspaper and saw a young Native American girl with a tear on her cheek. The photo accompanied a story about she had been beaten in several different housing situations. She was the face of a problem, a failure of social services on her reservation. Byron Dorgan is a former U.S. senator and congressman who represented North Dakota. His new book about what happened after he saw that newspaper photo is called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Senator Dorgan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon to you.
And also with us is Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute, based in Washington, D.C. Senator Dorgan founded the organization after deciding not to seek re-election. Nikki, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Dorgan, let's start with you. You tell the story of the girl in the photograph in great detail in the story. I wonder if you could highlight two moments for us, Senator Dorgan, when you saw her photo and then when she reached out to you on social media years later.
Yeah, well, I mean, I saw the photograph. It was a Sunday newspaper, top of the fold, color photograph of this beautiful young girl who had been beaten severely in a foster home on an Indian reservation. Her arm, her leg, her nose were broken, hair pulled out at the roots, and then she laid in an empty room for a couple of days with no medical attention. Think of that, at age two. And a couple of years later, they did a story about abuse of children on these foster homes and reservations, and that was her picture that I saw. And I went to meet her and her grandfather on that Indian reservation. She didn't seem like she knew I was there. She was pretty significantly altered and injured as a result of what had happened to her a couple years before. But at any rate, just to tell you, I then lost track of her. I sent her a couple of Christmas gifts to her grandfather, and her grandfather died. I would ask people on that reservation, do you know anybody know ever what ever happened to that little girl? And no one knew. No one had ever heard of her again. And so that was it. But I kept that photograph in my mind. I had that copy of the newspaper in my desk drawer for many, many years. 27 years later, I got an email from her. And it turns out she was homeless. She had been through hell. I mean, she had just been through so many problems. Homeless in Minneapolis. And she went to a library to use a computer to try to figure out what had happened to her because she had very little memory of her youth. And lo and behold, in her search using the computer at a library, she found a speech that I had given about her in the United States Senate. And I used her name. I told the story of her beating, and I did it in the context of what was happening to Native American youth. And as a result, she reached out to me and sent me an email. And that email, of course, created a whole series of events that I got involved in since. And so that's the story of how I learned about her and how we reconnected.
We'll hear more of that story. Nikki, I want to bring you into the picture now. You are directing the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. And something that strikes me looking at the efforts there, Nikki, is this isn't just about providing help to Native American youth. This is about helping Native American youth themselves take the lead in solving problems. Can you talk about the importance of that?
Absolutely. As a young Indigenous professional trying to navigate, this is something that I have grown up knowing my entire life, that we need to better our communities. Everything that we do is for the next generation. And so being able to have the opportunity to work at the Center for Native American Youth, which we are so grateful. I remember being a young professional and hearing about CNAY's creation and everything that Senator Dorgan had done for Indian Country prior, and being able to make sure that Native youth are at the forefront of policy change, of driving positive change in their community, not just saying that we need to be improving lives, but allowing Native youth and giving them the tools that they need to create that positive change is so inspiring. And so just so much gratitude for Senator Jorgen and also for the organization for allowing youth leaders to lead in this space. It's very much needed.
And Senator Jorgen, in the book, The Girl in the Photograph, you spend a lot of time talking about the challenges and problems facing Native Americans and Native American youth, and we'll get into that some. But you really are careful to say it's not just doom and gloom. Can you highlight some of the bright spots that you share in the book?
No, listen, I've written a book that's pretty heavy and, you know, about a young woman that's been through a lot. She's better now, but, you know, I wanted to shine all the spotlights on the same spot, the plight of Native American youth. And that's why I created the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. And from that center, we do something called Champions for Change that Nikki's involved with me in. And we find some unbelievably inspiring young Native Americans across the country. And they are our champions for change. They are mentors for other young people. They do unbelievable things. I've written a lot about them in the book. And, you know, it's important for people to know there's a lot left to do, but we do have some people out there, some young people on Indian reservations that are doing extraordinary things. This is an important time, and I would say, you know, there are two great stains on the American conscience, in my judgment. One is slavery, and the second is the way the first Americans, Native Americans, have been treated for over a couple centuries. They were the last people to get the right to vote. They've lived in great poverty, and you know they just have not been full participants in what America has become. And I think that needs to change.
Talking to Senator Byron Jorgen, a former senator from North Dakota. His new book is called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Also with us, Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. Senator Jorgen had founded that organization. Senator Jorgen, before we get back to Nikki to talk some more about the solutions they're working on there, can you lay out some of the problems that Tamara, the girl in the photograph herself, her life was just a microcosm of all these challenges facing, that there are common stories, sadly, for Native Americans on the country. Can you tell us some of what she encountered that she's just one of many examples of, sadly?
I will do that. But first, let me tell you, a man named Joseph Marshall, a historian, Lakota historian, was speaking in Colorado at a conference. And someone in the audience stood up and said to him, "Well, wait a second." And he was waving his arms. "Wait a second. Wasn't this dispute with respect to Native Americans, wasn't this dispute between your ancestors and my ancestors? Why am I held accountable? Why should I be held accountable?" And Joseph Marshall said to the men, "Because you know the story. Because you know the story. And when you know the story of an injustice, you have a responsibility to help change it." So that is such an important concept. Tamara is a young woman who has, you know, all the things that have visited her in a horrific way, the beating, the abuse. It deals with the substance abuse of her parents and abuse she suffered at the hands of many. She's been sexually abused. She has attempted to commit suicide several times. She's had great difficulty in education, and yet she's a very bright woman. She's now she's turned 35. She's in a better place, and I've spent a great deal of time with her and helping her. But, you know, a couple people that she never knew, strangers in her life, I think saved her life in many ways, and I can tell you those stories. But it's a circumstance where I wanted to use her story and the difficulties she has experienced, and she was happy to do that. She said, if telling my story helps other Native American children, I'm really, really happy that we can do that together. So that's what I've done. And her story is a microcosm of almost all the things that have been wrong and the things that need to be made right, and I think we can do it.
Nikki, can you talk about some things that you and the champions that Senator Jorgen mentioned that you work with at the Center for Native American Youth have done to tackle some of these problems that Senator Jorgen just laid out?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry, I just get kind of emotional when I think about this, because these are our own people. And something that we do with the Champions for Change is we have what's called Champions Week, where we bring them out to Washington, D.C., we celebrate their accomplishments. We celebrate the positive change they're trying to make. And we do very targeted curriculum training. We teach them about Advocacy 101. how to utilize social media as a platform. We teach them about the power in sharing your personal story. We bring them to Capitol Hill to meet with their senators. And we have a public event where we have Native youth, the Champions for Change, sharing the work that they're doing. And then we also have a reception that kind of celebrates their work and celebrates the work of the Center for Native American Youth. And so we don't stop there just after Champions for Change Week. We're on the road with them throughout the entire year. We're providing technical assistance to them, connecting them to like-minded organizations to help elevate their work. And then they join our Youth Advisory Board, which very much governs a lot of our programmatic work, along with Senator Dorgan and the Board of Advisors. And so the Champions for Change Week is just the beginning of a way that we stay engaged with these youth leaders and highlight the powerful work that they're doing to truly transform not just their communities, but society at large.
We're talking to former U.S. Senator from North Dakota, Byron Dorgan, and Nikki Petrie is also with us, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth. Senator Dorgan had founded that. It's at the Aspen Institute. We're talking about Senator Dorgan's new book. It's called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the challenges Native American youth are facing on or off of reservations? Do you have experience yourself as a part of that community or working with that community? Do you have a question for Senator Dorgan about what happens, how this all works at the congressional level, at the federal government level? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with former U.S. Senator from North Dakota, Byron Dorgan, and Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth. We're talking about Senator Dorgan's new book, The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Senator Dorgan's book highlights challenges, tragedies in some cases facing Native American youth, and opportunities, bright spots, people taking the lead through the Center for Native American Youth and elsewhere. If you have an experience in that story yourself, please call in at 800-642-1234. Senator Dorgan, in the book, you talk about problems like underfunded healthcare systems for Native Americans, underfunded educational systems. Now, inspired by Tamara and others, when you took these issues to the Senate floor, did your colleagues listen?
Well, not all of them listened, for sure. I mean, much of what exists there, particularly with respect to Indian health, is dramatically underfunded. It's estimated that only about 50% of the funds that are needed to provide for health care for Native Americans, only about 50% is available. You know, the federal government has promised Native Americans they would provide for their health care. That's in treaties. It's in writing. It's a promise that was made a long, long time ago, but it's a promise never kept. And we also have a responsibility to provide health care for federal prisoners. We run the federal prison in the federal government. But, you know, you spend almost twice as much on health care for federal prisoners per person as they do for Native Americans. I mean, that's just shameful. But I did want to say to you that a couple of the things that we work on, especially at the Center for Native American Youth, is teen suicide prevention on Indian reservations. There's too much teen suicide clusters that are very serious, and we're trying really hard to address this issue of teen suicide prevention. And then in addition, education opportunity and youth engagement. Those are the things that we spend a lot of time working on at the Center for Native American Youth.
And Nikki, Senator Dorgan talks in his book about the concept of historical trauma as a cause for loss of connection to culture and tradition in Native communities. Can you talk about that as part of the solution, reconnecting with those, I want to just say cultures and traditions?
Yeah. So the term that I like to use is historical resiliency. Mm. Despite the fact that, you know, how we had been discussing Natives were the last to vote, geographic isolation on many reservations, boarding schools, the list kind of goes on. Despite all of that, we are still here. We come from a warrior people. And so being able to instill that pride and instill that resiliency in our youth leaders. It's a cultural teaching. And so our youth leaders get it and they understand it. And so we're able to apply that into our programming that because of this, because we are resilient, we are able to make positive change that we need in our communities, such as teen suicide prevention, such as access to education for our people. So I think if we focus more on the resiliency and the power that youth leaders have to make this change, that's going to carry us through.
Let me just tell you a story I told in the book. I've told a good many stories in the book that are inspiring, but let me tell you a story about Dakota Brown, a young man who became our champion for change among a number of champions for change that we've selected. He was in school, in high school in California, saw his friends failing in class, going to be kicked off the football team and so on. And so he said to his best friend, who was a football star, who's going to lose his ability to play and get kicked out of school. He said, "You're as smart as I am, but he said, let me suggest something to you. I'll spend an hour a day, every day after school, to help you catch up and keep up with your studies. You know, you need to do this." And so they started an organization called NERDS, NERDS, Native Education Raising Dedicated Students. And all of a sudden it became kind of cool and others started. And kids that were, you know, these Native American kids who were getting C's and D's and F's began getting, you know, B's and A minus and C's. And the girl that was the youngest girl in that group, NERDS, she joined when she was in eighth grade because she was a slow learner. But she thought it was pretty neat, so she joined NERDS. Well, guess what? She just graduated from high school a couple years ago with a 4.0 grade point average. So Dakota Brown started that. He took it to three other schools. This young guy, by the way, is now at Stanford. It is such a great story, and there are a good many of those stories in this book as well that can describe great successes, even as I talk about the difficulty that Tamara has had and the life that she has had.
Talking to Senator Byron Dorgan, former senator from North Dakota, and Nikki Petrie, looking at Senator Dorgan's new book, The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Northeast Wisconsin. Tim, hello.
Hi. I'm not sure if you guys touched on this earlier. I had to step away from the radio for a bit. But I just wanted to comment on ICWA and some of the challenges that the Indian Child Welfare Act actually places on the system and in the challenge. We're a pre-adoptive ICWA-approved home, and we're fostering a three-year-old youth with the goal of adoption. And it's been nothing but frustrating, and just a tragic story all the way around for the family, for the child, and he's in a good spot now, and the mother pops back into the picture, and she's doing, you know, fairly good, but ICWA requires so much active effort to put that child back in that bad situation that it's just ridiculous. It's to the point where the mother was sentenced to probation, and 2 weeks later, you know, there she is, you know, in a place that she's not supposed to be with.
Tim, thank you for sharing that story. Senator Dorgan, I heard you kind of nodding along there. Can you talk about challenges in that foster care system?
I can, but I know both sides of the ICWA debate. Sure. I really do. And I say to that gentleman, God bless you for wanting to love a young child and adopt a child. There has been a time that created ICWA as a result of a lot of children being taken away from parents and taken away from their culture and moved hundreds of miles and thousands of miles away and prevented from being a part of that culture. ICWA was created, and I understand that it has made it more difficult for some in some cases, but ultimately it will work if he's patient and it's the right thing. I think the process will work for him. But we also want to make certain that those young children that are taken away, and Tamara, by the way, was taken from her abusive alcoholic parents, that's not where you want a child to be. But when you do take someone away from that circumstance, we also want them to be able to be a part of and understand their culture going forward as well. So that's I understand both sides of that ICWA debate, but when it was enacted by a senator from South Dakota, Senator Ebrusk, it was really needed back then, and I think is still needed, but it has made sometimes things a bit more difficult, but has also improved things as well.
Thanks for the call, Tim. We just have a few minutes left. Nikki, briefly, if there's a young Native American person listening right now, maybe seeing whatever the challenges in their local community, how would you encourage them to become active and take on a leadership role themselves?
I think the first thing I would tell them is that they are already a leader. Just by being present and whatever they're going through, that they deserve to be empowered, supported, and loved, and that they have everything that it takes. So find that fire that they have within them and go out and make the positive change and turn to resources like the Center for Native American Youth to be an ally and to help support and promote their work, and that they are very much loved and respected and are leaders.
And Senator Dorgan, in our last minute and a half, you've been working on these issues for a long time. Some dark stories out there, but do you feel optimistic looking back at the last couple decades?
I do. It's been a tough couple centuries, as a matter of fact, for Native Americans. But there's a lot of inspiring things happening, and I think things can and will improve. I've written a number of other books, a couple of them about economics and a couple novels and so on. This was a hard book to write, but one that I absolutely felt needed to be written, and it was published by St. Martin's Press in New York. And I hope people take a look at it and understand, when you see an injustice and know of an injustice, when you know the story, all of us have a responsibility to address it.
Senator Dorgan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Nikki, thanks to you for being with us.
Thank you much. Thank you. Bye.
We've been talking to Byron Dorgan, former U.S. Senator and Congressman from North Dakota, and Nikki Petrie, Acting Executive Director of the Center for Native American Youth. We talked to them today about Senator Dorgan's new book. It's called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Coming up, our next guest has a message for Democrats across the country. He says, stop playing it so safe. We'll find out what he means by that, what it looks like, and what it means for the 2020 elections coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, COVID-19 continues to spread across Wisconsin, the U.S., and many parts of the world. Our guest doctor answers your questions about what the virus does, how it's spread, who's most at risk, how it's treated, and how healthcare providers are responding. First, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is reportedly reassessing his presidential campaign after being swept in three primaries this week. He now trails former Vice President Joe Biden in delegates 1,091 to 778. You need 1,991 to win the nomination. The Sanders campaign is no longer actively advertising on Facebook as of earlier today. His campaign manager also emailed supporters without asking for donations, but he's not suspending his bid for president despite calls by some Democrats to do so. After a disappointing performance on Super Tuesday earlier this month, Sanders held a news conference telling his party that they can't afford to write off his supporters.
Today, I say to the Democratic establishment, in order to win in the future, you need to win the voters who represent the future of our country, and you must speak to the issues of concern to them. You cannot simply be satisfied by winning the votes of people who are older.
As the nomination contest continues, our guest has a message for the Democratic Party. Stop playing it safe or risk losing to President Trump again. Mike McCabe is a government reform advocate and the executive director of Our Wisconsin Revolution. Mike, good to have you back with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob. Good to be with you.
You wrote a piece, Mike, right after Super Tuesday. You called Democrats, quote, a scared party, an apologetic party, a play it safe party, end quote. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are an awful lot of people who are, having that feeling of deja vu. I don't think I'm alone in that. And it does kind of feel like we're stuck in the movie Groundhog Day, where the same day is replaying over and over again. And you know, we've had five elections so far in the 21st century, and in three of them, Democrats nominated an establishment candidate, long-time, elected officials or long-time government establishment types. And in those three elections, they lost. And then in one election in 2008, it was an insurgent candidate, one who was not the presumptive nominee, who broke through and got the nomination. And it was a black man with a name that sounded like a cross between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. And I can't tell you how many people I heard back then say, you know, America wasn't ready to elect a black man, and certainly not one with a name like Barack Obama. And yet he won, and then he got reelected again in 2012. And so when the Democrats have gone the establishment route, they have lost so far in the 21st century, and nobody thought that Donald Trump was electable in 2016. Republicans said there was no chance that he would get their party's nomination, and then you heard Democrats saying that he was the dream opponent of Hillary Clinton, and yet look who wound up in the White House. There are mammoth problems facing our country, even as we practice all kinds of take all kinds of precautions for the sake of public health as we deal with this pandemic. Once we get through this, there are going to be these huge problems facing this country: economic inequality, health insecurity, crushing student debt, environmental insanity, climate crisis that need to be dealt with. And Americans sense that we need some drastic changes. And when the political system doesn't offer any hope of those drastic changes being made to deal with these mammoth problems, you had a lot of people in 2016 who were ready to throw a Molotov cocktail at the political establishment. And Donald Trump was a very big Molotov cocktail. And our country is going through these huge problems. We're really going through three revolutions at once: an economic revolution driven by globalization and automation that has put an awful lot of people who used to have good factory jobs with health insurance and pensions and family supporting wages out of work. They watched their jobs exported overseas or automated out of existence as the robots took over. We're going through a social revolution where the historically dominant group in America is fast becoming a minority. We're going through an ecological revolution that threatens life on this planet. And Donald Trump has answers for all of those revolutions. For the economic revolution, he's just said, let's slap tariffs on all the foreign products, and that'll bring back all the manufacturing jobs. For the social revolution, he says, let's build a wall spanning the entire southern border and make Mexico pay for it. With the ecological revolution, he says that climate change is a hoax. We don't have to worry about it. We can continue to pollute without harm. And it doesn't matter if those answers are bad answers. Those answers are disastrous answers for our country. But in the absence of alternative answers, in the absence of drastic changes being recommended by the opposition, people will grab onto that, and they did in 2016. And if the Democratic Party doesn't offer serious solutions and drastic change for some of these mammoth challenges that we face, there's a path to re-election for Donald Trump, and I think that would be disastrous for our country.
A response to that often, Mike, is if we have that person who offers these drastic solutions from the left, more or less, you're going to scare off a lot of voters, maybe even traditional Democratic voters, who then either vote for Donald Trump or stay home. That's, I think, the electability argument in a nutshell.
Well, and the electability argument is based on assumptions that are no longer valid. There's been this long time assumption for decades that electability is found in the center, that you've got to compete for all of these voters in the middle who are between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Well, I don't think I'm alone. And I've gone out there and traveled over 100,000 miles in the course of just 11 months and talked to more Trump voters than I can imagine. And, and I've knocked on an awful lot of doors and talked to an awful lot of voters. I can't find that center anymore. That middle is gone. Independents are just as polarized as the rest of the electorate. They, you know, some of them are on the left, some of them are on the right. They don't like either major party. That's what really defines them as independents. That idea that to be electable, you've got to be in the center and you've got to be able to compete for the middle. When politics becomes as polarized as it is today, the center vanishes. And the middle's not there anymore. There aren't any voters in the middle anymore. What people, and I think that's how Donald Trump got elected. He didn't run in the center. He ran as a real extremist, and he ended up in the White House. And I think the electability argument that so many Democrats are leaning on, I think unfortunately for them is an argument that's based on assumptions that are outdated and no longer valid. And that's the concern, is that if you pursue a course based on this idea of electability, but the idea of electability is based on assumptions that are now invalid, that is the kind of thing that gave Donald Trump a path to the White House in 2016. And it gives him a path to re-election in 2020 if that kind of argument continues to prevail.
Talking to Mike McCabe from the group Our Wisconsin Revolution, he says Democrats need to be bolder, have a stronger, more liberal or progressive agenda. I want to give a listen to both candidates at their most recent debate. Joe Biden, first of all, and then Bernie Sanders both talk about Medicare for all in the midst of the COVID-19 outbreak. Here's a listen to former Vice President Biden.
With all due respect to Medicare for all, you have a single-payer system in Italy. It doesn't work there. It has nothing to do with Medicare for all. That would not solve the problem at all. We can take care of that right now by making sure that no one has to pay for treatment, period, because of the crisis. No one has to pay for whatever drugs are needed, period, because of the crisis. No one has to pay for hospitalization because of the crisis, period. That is a national emergency, and that's how it's handled. It is not working in Italy right now, and they have a single-payer system. Well,
and then listen to Senator Sanders on the same issue.
In terms of Medicare for all, despite what the vice president is saying, what the experts tell us is that one of the reasons that we are unprepared and have been unprepared is we don't have a system. We got thousands of private insurance plans. That is not a system that is prepared to provide health care to all people. In a good year, without the epidemic, we're losing up to 60,000 people who die every year because they don't get to a doctor on time. And clearly this crisis is only making a bad situation worse.
So, Mike, a more timely spin on a key issue of division, I think, for Democrats, how ambitious to be, how big a change they want to see in the health care system. What's your read on that and how it fits into what you're talking about?
Changing every day, Rob. You know, there's now talk that unemployment might spike to as much as 20% across this country. We have a health insurance system that is hitched to employment. As people lose their employment, they lose their health insurance. They lose their ability to go to the doctor. And then on top of that, we have a system in this country where not only are there many who are uninsured, but there are many more who have insurance but can't use the insurance because the deductibles and copays are so high that the out-of-pocket expense is so great that they can't afford to actually use the insurance they have. And there are so many Americans, millions and millions of Americans, who have health insurance, but it's basically useless to them. Because the only way that it will ever be used is if they became so sick and required such prolonged hospitalization that eventually the deductibles would be covered and their insurance would kick in. But when we have a situation like the one we're in right now, if unemployment spikes to 10 or 15 or 20%, there will be so many Americans who will lose health insurance because health insurance is tethered to employment in this country. That it puts our country in an incredibly vulnerable position. And I think more and more people will become aware that, my goodness, this is no way to provide health security in one of the world's wealthiest countries.
We're talking about the state of the Democratic Party with Mike McCabe, Executive Director of Our Wisconsin Revolution. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think Democrats need to do to win in 2020? Do you agree with our guests that they play it too safe and need to embrace full-blown liberal progressive policies? Or do you think a more moderate approach, a more moderate candidate is the way to go? If you're looking at this from outside the Democratic Party, love to hear from you and your thoughts as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking with Mike McCabe, government reform advocate and executive director of Our Wisconsin Revolution. He wrote a piece after Super Tuesday saying today's Democrats are an apologetic party and a play-it-safe party. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Democrat, do you want a more moderate candidate or somebody further to the side of liberal, progressive politics, big, ambitious changes, or stay the course or restore the course? If you're a supporter of President Trump, which candidate would you rather win the Democratic nomination? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Elkhorn. John, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm going to probably just stick to a couple of topics. One, Mr. McCabe, I really appreciate what you're saying, because I probably find myself in that ballpark of being a more liberal and progressive individual. But Donald Trump is a very unique individual. And my support for Joe Biden isn't necessarily because I'm overwhelmed with Joe Biden, but I just don't see how a candidate like Bernie Sanders would ever be able to win. And if this was another time and place, I would probably be willing to go down that road with him. But you know what? I don't see it. You know what? And Barack Obama was actually probably a little bit more centrist, other than his name, than we probably give him credit for. And he was very pragmatic.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, a lot of primary voters appear to have agreed with John over the last few weeks in primary voting.
Indeed, and I guess what I would say is that is a great illustration of what distinguishes today's Republican Party from today's Democratic Party, is that, you know, Democratic voters are sort of compromising with themselves. They're saying that what they believe in, what they want, the kind of change that they're looking for, they don't think is possible. Whereas the Republicans just seem hell bent on imposing their will and getting their way no matter what, and they're not ashamed of their governing philosophy. They don't hesitate to just impose their will on the country. And you know, I go back to the last time that we had unemployment as high as some think that it may reach in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. And that takes you all the way back to the time of the Great Depression, and unemployment went up to 25%. And of course, America had a four-term president who was constantly called a socialist, and whose policies, the policies that he ushered in, were every bit as socialist as anything that Bernie Sanders is suggesting today, and perhaps even more so. And yet, he was elected four times in this country, the only person ever to be elected president of the United States four times, and that, of course, was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And you know, Roosevelt famously gave a speech, his second inaugural address, where he said that the forces of organized money were united in their hatred of him, and he welcomed their hatred. That sounds an awful lot like the kind of message that Bernie Sanders is spreading across the country today. And Franklin Roosevelt wasn't afraid of the opposition from the country's aristocracy. He took it on and said, look, regular working people are suffering, and we're going to look out for them. We're going to make major changes in this country. And of course, and that happened with the New Deal. And in more recent years, it seems as though the Democratic Party has lost faith in its own governing philosophy. And, you know, I talk to so many voters who say, yes, the ideas, Medicare for all and a Green New Deal and dealing with this crushing student debt for young people, these are all things that we need to do. But then in the next breath, they say, but you know, it could never pass, or we could never afford it.
I'm going to jump in, Mike, because I want to bring in another caller or two before we run out of time. We'll go to Susan in West Allis. Susan, hi.
Hi. I do hope that Bernie Sanders does not drop out. I think in the past, Joe Biden has made some bad decisions, and I remember watching the Anita Hill proceedings, and he didn't help in any way to, we ended up with Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, also his support for the war in Iraq and many other things. Plus, they thought they had the perfect candidate for in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. And they were wrong because she just did not have the charisma. And I think you really need somebody with charisma.
Susan, thanks for the call. Micah, what do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that is going to be required to beat Donald Trump is excitement and enthusiasm and a belief, more than anything else, a belief that the major challenges facing this country are being addressed. And for people who feel like, you know what, the system is rigged against us and nobody seems to be addressing the problems that we're facing, somebody who, you know, used to make $25 or $30 an hour on a factory floor, who watched their job exported overseas or automated out of existence, and they don't feel like anybody cares about that or anybody's doing anything about it. You know, Trump offered an answer. He said, I'm going to slap tariffs on all these foreign products, and I'm going to bring all these manufacturing jobs back. And, of course, it hasn't happened, but people were hungry for an answer, and he provided them an answer. And he said, I'll build a wall across the southern border, and Mexico will pay for it. And, of course, that's not happening either, but people were hungry for an answer. They want somebody who... It gives them confidence that they understand the mammoth challenges facing this country, and they're willing to take dramatic action to deal with those challenges. And if that doesn't come from the Democratic Party, that's what got Donald Trump elected in the first place in 2016. And it does offer him a path to reelection in 2020, despite all that's happened.
In just our last minute or so, Mike, our last caller said she hopes that Senator Sanders stays in the race. Do you think that Senator Sanders' presence, ongoing presence in the race, might change where Democrats and a possible candidate, Joe Biden, where their policies would end up?
Absolutely. When you look at the 2016 election, before 2016, nobody was talking about Medicare for all. Nobody was talking about a Green New Deal. Nobody was talking about dealing with the student debt crisis, and he brought a message into that race that in 2020 all the candidates had to talk about Medicare for all the and many of them actually embraced it, and you know, so there's already been a great deal of change because that ambitious message was put out there before the American people, and so many people responded to it favorably. I think that same effect is going to continue in 2020 and beyond. It's incredibly important for as many voices as possible in this country to be talking about the huge challenges, the three revolutions that this country is going through all at once, and then how we deal with those revolutions, both economic, social, and ecological, and how we get ourselves out of these messes.
Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Mike McCabe, government reform advocate and executive director of the group Our Wisconsin Revolution. We talked to him about his call for Democrats to stop being what he calls a play-it-safe party and to stand firm on a liberal platform. He wrote a piece about that just after Super Tuesday. By the way, circumstances around the novel coronavirus are changing all the time. It can be tough to feel like you have the most up-to-date and accurate info. Wisconsin Public Radio wants to make sure you have the information you need and that you're getting answers to your questions. You can share your questions about COVID-19, the virus prevention, preparation, what concerns you have that you need answers to. These questions will help inform our coverage. We'll do our best to answer them. Go to WPR.org to submit your questions and your concerns about COVID-19. You can do that at WPR.org. And in just a few minutes after the news, we'll talk to a doctor who's going to answer some of the questions you've posed to us, either through the website, through our social media, and elsewhere. That's coming up in just a few. Looking for some fun news in the midst of the worrisome stuff? How about puppies, or puppies, if you will, as you like to call them? Next Monday, it turns out, is National Puppy Day, so it's a chance to celebrate, I don't know, by appreciating your puppy all the more. The medical insurance company, we saw this email, a company called Trupanion, they released a list of their clients' most popular puppy names of the last year. So let's check it out. It's a top 10 list. I'll start at the bottom. The number 10 most popular name was Molly for puppies. Teddy. These are kind of people names. They think they're people. Rosie. Then moving up the list, number 7, Max the puppy. Daisy. You can see that one going, human or dog. Lucy the puppy. Number 4, most popular puppy name over the last year is Cooper. Then we've got Charlie. Now, number 2, I see this all over the place, some variation on this, Bella. And I've seen dogs. There's dogs in my neighbor. There's a Bella. There's a Belle. This is a pretty common dog name these days. Number 1 is Luna. If you have puppies by any of those names, well, you better send us a picture. Heck, any puppy. Send us a picture. Ideas@WPR.org. Right now, do it. We want some puppy pictures. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.